This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. From horns to claws, teeth and talons, natural weapons are abundant throughout the animal kingdom. But my guest today wanted to know why some animals develop weapons that are dramatically outsized for their body, like a bull elk that grows 40-pound antlers. So he dug into the literature and studied creatures ranging from beetles to walruses, and he kept coming back to the same theory. An evolutionary arms race pushes animal weapons to the extreme. Doug Emlin is an evolutionary biologist whose new book, Animal Weapons, The Evolution of Battle, examines the biological arms race phenomenon and its many parallels with human arms races throughout history, and he joins me now to talk about it. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you.
Tell us how you got interested in this kind of extreme animal weapons arms race.
Well, I guess I confess I've been obsessed with animals that creatures that are so bizarre, they look like they shouldn't be possible for quite a while now. And that interest led me to beetles. Most of us don't spend that much time thinking about beetles, but actually some of these species have spectacular weapons. And I've spent a number of years digging into the biology of these extreme structures. But as you mentioned in the lead-in, I took a break from that a few years ago and started looking at literature on all kinds of extreme weapons, because there are such a diversity of animals that produce these arguably ridiculous structures. I mean, things that are so big, the animals look like they should tip over or trip or get tangled in the branches around them. And that really is what led me down that rabbit hole of what's the common biology of these species, what pushes them into these arms races that leads to such extraordinary weapons.
Well, let's stick with those beetles for a moment, because anybody who's seen a stag beetle or some of the other great horned beetles knows what you're talking about. These things look just downright weird. And I guess the question is, for me, whether the horns, for instance, are for protection or if they're for some kind of mating, dominance, what role do they play in beetles?
Sure, and that is something that we've spent many years thinking about. You mentioned some of my all-time favorites. Stag beetles and rhinoceros beetles are incredible. And these are weapons that are used in battles over access to reproduction. So these are not weapons that are there for protection. They're there for fights, often intense battles between rival males over access to females.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, so in that sense, the biology of the horns on these rhinoceros beetles or the antlers and stag beetles is very, very similar to what we see with the giant claws in fiddler crabs or, as you mentioned, the huge antlers on elk or caribou or deer.
Now, this would be useful, it seems to me. I mean, if you follow through on the logic, you would hope that the animal that has the biggest horns would somehow have the best genetic makeup because they're likely to have a very good love life. And therefore, you just kind of want their genes to go on. So is there a correlation between those horns, those antlers, and how strong, how fit an animal they are?
There is. There's an incredible correlation. And this is part of the biology of these arms races that unfolds. And so once you get situations in these particular species where selection favors bigger and bigger and bigger weapons, these things start to get big fast. And as they get big, they get expensive. And in many cases, these things are extraordinarily expensive. And what happens is they become so costly that most of the males in the populations can't afford to pay the price. If you go out there and you look at something like a rhinoceros beetle population, and you don't just look at one in a picture, but you look at 100 of the different males and you measure the sizes of the weapons, what you find is almost all of them produce medium or even tiny weapons. There's only a very small fraction of the males that can afford to pay the price for the biggest weapons of all. And those tend to be the best quality individuals with access to the best resources, in the best physical state, best immune systems. It's not an accident that only the healthiest, biggest, best males are the ones that produce the really big weapons. And those are the animals that win. And they do tend to be the ones with the highest reproductive success in these populations.
So that's interesting. I mean, the correlation is, if I can afford this thing, I mean, it's a little like status symbols among humans, right? If I can afford all this stuff, means I got a lot of stuff. And if wealth and security is your goal, marry me. And so that's what you're saying with the elk. But let's move now to the elk world, for instance, those giant racks of antlers, right? And you talk about the cost. Talk about what happens to the animal, the individual animal itself is paying a price walking around with these huge antlers.
They are. And these prices are, as I said, pretty incredible. So there are a number of really neat studies that have looked at, in the case of the cervids, the deer, the elk, the antelope, I mean, the elk and the caribou, at what these costs are. And just to pick an example, sometimes the biggest males with the biggest antlers invest as much materially in terms of caloric cost as a cow or a female in these species would raising two calves all the way to weaning. So that's a stunning investment that these males are shunting into the growth of these weapons. And when you look at just the minerals that make up the bone of things like antlers, the costs are extreme. They can't get enough from their diet. And so what happens is when they're growing these antlers, and these animals do it every year, they shed their antlers and have to turn around and grow them back again the next year. They have to leach calcium and phosphorus and some of these minerals that they need to make the bone and the antlers. They have to pull it out of their own skeletons. It's a type of deficit spending, if you want to draw the parallel. They're leaching these things out of their other bones in their bodies to put them into the antlers. And that means that these things end up going through a seasonal period of osteoporosis. Their bones are weakened and brittled in the rest of their body at exactly the time of year when they're smashing into rival males in these all-out knockdown battles over access to females.
Well, that's another interesting point, is the fact that they look strong and mighty at their weakest moment. How come they aren't losing more battles and you know, throwing off the whole equation and the whole theory in this arms race?
Well, so there's a twist there too. And it comes back to this idea, that not all of the males can afford to pay this price. And so these weapons, when they get big and when they get expensive, they make very effective signals. And males will start to use these weapons as deterrents. They will size each other up, and two males will literally compare the sizes of their weapons side by side and use that information to decide whether to escalate into full battle. So one of the reasons they don't lose all the time is that the males with smaller weapons often abort. They walk away before escalating into battles that they would otherwise lose. And so this sort of dual function of these weapons is a diagnostic of these really extreme structures. It's only when these things get really big and really expensive, and only when a very small fraction of the males can afford to pay that price, that's when you suddenly have a very effective signal. Because looking at the size of the weapon tells you a lot about whether the opponent you face is likely to win or not.
So you just wisely back down. When it comes to, though, the beetle world, let's get back to these beetles.
Favorites.
Your favorites. And you tracked a fascinating phenomenon there where, in effect, the arms race escalated to a certain point, and then a kind of subversion, a sort of dynamic took effect that allowed beetles with smaller horns to start to win, a kind of asymmetrical warfare.
That's exactly what happens. And so you get to this point where the biggest, best animals are able to pay the price. And for those, that small fraction of animals, it's worth paying the price because they are able to guard access to females and sort of derive a reproductive or a fitness benefit for investing in the weapons. But the smaller males can't pay that price. And what are you going to do? You can't produce the big weapons. You're not going to win the fights. And in species after species, the small males switch to plan B. And instead of facing the rivals in conventional battle, they turn around and they use, as you said, asymmetrical tactics. They sneak. So in the beetle example, many of the species, the dung beetles, for example, where the males often have really big horns, they dig these tunnels into the ground beneath the piles of manure or dung, and the big males with the horns guard themselves, guard the tunnels. They plant themselves at the entrance, and they fight rival males to get into the tunnels, and the females are deeper down in the tunnels. The little males sneak. Instead of trying to fight a battle they won't win, they dig their own tunnel. And then once they get a little bit below ground, they cut horizontally and they can mine their way into the main tunnel, sneak in there beneath the big guarding male, go right down to the female, mate with the female, and sneak out again. So it's a completely different tactic. It's a subversive tactic, a cheating tactic that allows the little guys who aren't investing and spending in big weapons to find ways to access the females. And that can stall an arms race, because what it does is it erodes the payoffs to the big guys that are paying all the resources to produce the big weapons.
Is there any indication that the animals with the biggest weapons pass that ability on genetically, so that, you know, well, I guess they do, because it's pretty much everybody in that colony is theirs, right?
Yes and no. The genetics gets a little bit more complicated in the examples of the beetles, because what happens is that individuals have sort of lurking within their genomes the capacity to adopt either the plan A or the plan B. And so if they happen to develop under circumstances where the nutrition is great, the conditions are great, they're doing really well, they're competitively superior, they will grow the full weapons and adopt sort of plan A. if they happen to be raised under poor conditions, when the nutrition is terrible or when there's lots of pathogens or parasites and they're not growing as well and they're not likely to be competitive, they can switch to plan B. And so in a sense, you get sort of selection, fine-tuning, and honing performance at both tactics, but it's not as simple as you inherit alleles that tell you to do one thing or the other.
Yeah,
you actually have sort of a facultative two-part strategy that lets you make the best of whatever circumstance you encounter.
Yeah, and I guess that answers the next question is what would that do to the gene pool if all these sneaks were able to reproduce? But you're saying it adds to diversity so that they can then manage change in the environment.
But what it does do is it changes the nature of the arms race. Because as long as the sneaky males aren't really doing all that well on average, it's still going to be cost effective for these males to be shunting huge amounts of resources into really big weapons. So the conventional arsenals still are profitable or cost effective. But if the sneaky guys start doing too well and they start stealing too much of the fertilizations or the reproductive success, what they do is they drop the bottom out from the payoffs or the rewards to the weapons. And it makes – you can get a situation where the conventional weapons aren't cost effective anymore. It can stop an arms race and cease the continued sort of escalated evolution of bigger and bigger sizes. In some cases, it may actually collapse an arms race and lead to the complete loss of the expensive weapons.
But not to the species itself. In other words, it's no threat or has not, that you can see, become a threat to the species.
As far as we know, what happens is it's fatal to the weapon. It leads to the loss of the big weapons. It doesn't usually lead to the loss of the species. There's one example where it might have led to the loss of the species, but that would be the Irish elk. But that's a tricky example and it's hard to know. No, most of the time what happens is suddenly the big weapons aren't cost effective. And individuals that ditch them and don't produce them in the first place start doing a lot better. And the populations quickly evolve to get rid of the expensive weapons. So there are parallels to human arms races with every single one of these steps here.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that because that's something that certainly occurred to your editors and is now a big part of your book. Tell us about those parallels.
It was a surprise for me. I started out, I'm a biologist, right? I work on beetle weapons. And so it was a big enough leap for me to start looking at all these other crazy things, at crabs and at flies with crazy antlers and wasps with tusks and mastodons and, you know, all these other diverse animals with weapons. But the more I dug, the more clear it became that the same kinds of circumstances spark arms races in all of these different species. And once the arms races start, the same kinds of things unfold. So the stages of the arms race are almost identical. And when they collapse for the same reasons. And when it became clear that there was this sort of common biology of arms races, that's when my editors kept saying, hey, you got to look at the human weapons too. And my first reaction is, no way. That's a whole nother literature, and I'm not a military historian, but they kept saying, you got to do this. We think there's parallels. And once I started digging into that literature, there was no turning back. It was incredible. There are a lot of brilliant people that have spent a lot of time thinking about arms races in our own military past. But when you start applying the logic of biology, you take that sort of framework and start looking at that military history, the parallels are incredible. I'm convinced now that the same types of circumstances spark arms races in our own military traditions, that the arms races unfold in precisely the same ways, and that they collapse for the same kinds of reasons. So I'm really glad in hindsight that my editor sort of nudged me down into that rabbit hole.
Well, give us a sense. I mean, I think we know where we are today, or at least sort of in the mid-20th century, there was this arms race, mutual assured destruction. And then as we move into the end of the century, we see how asymmetric warfare can actually upend that track. But take us back earlier. What are some of the more interesting rises and falls of arms in history occur?
Well, sure. So the Cold War and the aftermath of the Cold War is probably the most familiar to most of us, and we can come back to that in a minute if you want. But no, there are lots of examples of arms races throughout history. And by arms races, I'm talking about periods where you had a long period of stasis where the weapons stayed essentially the same. And then something changed. Something about the circumstances or the context in which these weapons were used changed. And it changed in a way where all of a sudden it really paid to have the bigger weapon. And from that point forward, you know, the populations of weapons, if you will, the technology sort of surge forward and you get bigger and bigger and bigger or more complicated or faster and better weapons that start costing more and more and more to produce. And you sort of launch into this rapid escalated transition of weapon growth and weapon evolution. And those are the type, that's what I mean by an arms race. And those things tend to be triggered by the same circumstances. So if you'll let me run with one parallel, one of the triggers or the preconditions that sparks an arms race in animals has to do with the nature of the fight. if you've got beetles out there tussling around and piling around in a big chaotic scramble, it doesn't pay to produce really big expensive weapons because the fights are completely chaotic and there's a very large stochastic component to who wins. So it wouldn't matter if you had a really big expensive weapon. You still might lose anyway because of chance, and it's not worth paying the price. But if you have fights that unfold as duels, sort of matched one-on-one contests of strength, that changes everything. Because in a duel, then the outcomes are very predictable. And the bigger, stronger male, which usually means the male with the bigger weapons, wins. And so simple changes in animal behavior. Come back to the dung beetles. I told you before that they fight in these tunnels. Well, the tunnels align the contests. So lots of dung beetles will roll these balls on the surface above the ground, and they fight in these big scrambles, and none of the ball-rolling dung beetles ever have big weapons or horns. But the species that fight in tunnels do, because inside a tunnel, your fights are aligned. You can't fight 10 rivals at the same time. They can't pile on top of you because they have to come into the tunnel to face you, and only one male can fit into the tunnel at a time. And so tunnels change the nature of battle so that all of a sudden, bigger weapons do better and they can spark an arms race. So if you use that same logic and you go back to human military history, changes in technology often change the way that weapons confront each other, taking what had been a scramble and turning it into duels. And the simplest, neatest example of this took place ages ago in the Mediterranean, where we had 1,000 years of stasis where the weapons were the same. These ships, these oared galleys would shuttle troops from place to place across the Mediterranean. And for hundreds of years, the ships stayed the same size, same basic shape, same numbers of people on them, same numbers of rowers. Then somebody invents a battering ram. New technology, twist. One thing, you stick essentially a horn, a bronze protrusion on the front of the boats, and everything changed. Because all of a sudden, ships could strike and sink other ships. And that had to happen one at a time. You can't strike 6 ships at once. You've got a battering ram. You smash into one ship, close range, you've got duels. And as soon as the battering ram appeared, just like that, it all of a sudden, you had to have the bigger ship, the faster ship. The country with the biggest ships won. And you started on this incredible arms race, and they started adding rowers, and the ships got longer and longer until they buckled. And then they started adding 2 layers of rowers, and then 3 layers of rowers, and then they put more and more people at each oar. And within about 50 to 100 years, you went from ships that had maybe 25 oars on a side to ships that had 4,000 oarsmen and 3,000 troops on the decks. So there was an explosion of ship size, and it all came back to one simple change in the way those two contestants faced each other. You went from a scramble to a duel. So the same logic that applies to beetles applies to ships in the ancient Mediterranean.
The logic applies, but the mechanisms are different in that those things happen to beetles that are finding themselves in various environments. Humans have a kind of intention that allows them to make these things in ways that other species can't.
Really glad you bring that up. Sorry, I didn't mean to
cut you off. No, go ahead, please.
Question, but this is a really important point that I'm glad you mentioned, because when you start comparing arms races, or you compare the evolution of weapons in animals and in our own technologies, there are some fundamental differences that are important to keep clear. When we're talking about evolution of weapons in beetles or in elk or crabs, in that case, the currency that matters is reproductive success. The males with the biggest, best weapons win. They mate with the largest proportions of the females in the population. The majority of kids in that population are their genetic offspring. And so the population evolves towards bigger and bigger weapons because the individual males with those weapons win and they have higher reproductive success. When we talk about the evolution of military weapons, human weapons, manufactured weapons, it's a different currency. We're not talking about reproductive success of the soldiers that are using the weapons at all. We're talking about performance of the weapon. And the populations that matter aren't populations of people the way that they are populations of beetles, for example. They're populations of the weapons. So the population of ships would be all the ships out there in all of the navies combined at one point in time. And you could look at how changes in ship design occurred as shipbuilders sort of tweaked and modified and altered the ship technologies. And so ships that performed well would quickly be copied and manufactured in numbers, and they would start to spread and they'd become more and more common. And ships that performed poorly would be discarded and disappear. So you can talk about the evolution, the turnover of weapon design, and you can talk about changes in weapons evolving, but it is a different currency of success, and it is a slightly different process than the biological evolution that we see in beetles or caribou. But when you look at the weapons, the story is the same.
Fascinating stuff, Doug. Thank you for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Doug Emlin is the author of the new book, Animal Weapons, The Evolution of Battle. And you can find out more information about his research and the book at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the North Carolina Symphony plays an American classic. Stay tuned.